jumped a big jump from the last sermon, looking in this story of the Bible, the worldview of the Bible. We've jumped from Genesis chapter 3, a whole book, to Exodus chapter 3. In the first few chapters of the Bible, where we spent several weeks, we built some of the big building blocks in understanding who God is, as the Bible teaches us, in understanding who we are and what's wrong with this world and what's the result of those sorts of breaks and flaws and sin, as the Bible says, that's wrong with this world. We built the broad, philosophical, foundational, universal themes. And we looked at themes that are very important in defending and understanding how the Bible makes sense, its coherence, its philosophy, its way of interpreting us and our world. Very, very important things that really, if you want to understand yourself what Christianity is about, you need to understand those early chapters well. And if you want to critique and defend Christianity, you need to really understand those things well. We looked at the existence of one eternal, transcendent, and yet personal Creator God. A God who created this world and created a good world as a theatre for His glory to show who He is and how creative and beautiful and wonderful He is. And created people in His image to reflect something unique about who He is and to bring blessing and ruling over the world. And we looked at how we humans have rebelled against God and His good will and purpose for the world. And so the image of God in us has been darkened and shattered, that we fail to honour God, we fail to really treat one another as we ought, and our relationship with the world itself is all junked up. We now stand under God's anger, God's judgment. We now are broken away from our relationship with God, and we inherit a world that's a mess as a result, and we face a future which is fearful, a future of death and of being accountable toward God as a result. But from Genesis chapter 12 in particular onwards, the Bible becomes much, much narrower, more concrete, more historical, more particular, more personal. It'd be helpful just to have a look quickly at Genesis 12. It's one of those important markers in the whole Bible. And for someone who is a Christian and wanting to grow in their Christian understanding, it's one of those verses that needs to be known and to be memorized and to be understood. Genesis chapter 12. Some have even said that you could well break up the Bible into two massive chunks. The first massive chunk being Genesis 1 to 11. The second much larger chunk being Genesis chapter 12 to Revelation 22. So important is this chapter. Genesis chapter 12. The Lord had said to Abram, a guy, the Lord had said to Abram, leave your country, your people, your father's household, and go to the land, a place, just a place. Go to the land, I will show you. I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse. And all peoples on earth will be blessed through you. Here is a personal, verbal revelation of God and His grace, His promise to forgive and to bless a world under cursing. And out of this comes the salvation of Israel, God acting on those promises for the forgiveness, the blessing, the establishing of a community of those who do know God, who do love Him, who enjoy His forgiveness and look forward to a renewal of a world that is broken. Things, you see, from this point on are no longer as general and broad and philosophical and universal, but become much more local, concrete, geographical, historical. These things appeal to our realness. We're not just philosophers. We're not just people in some general legal sense, you know, the Human Rights Convention or something. We're individuals from particular places, particular fears, particular needs, particular relationships. And here we have the very real world story from here on of people, particular people. Their particular struggles, fears, doubts, hypocrisies. But the question this all forces us to ask, the Bible I think in particular has such a insistently historical book forces us to ask is, did God actually talk to people? Do you really believe in an interventionist God who talks to people so that God could talk to you? God could talk to you. Do we really believe this? Has God actually acted in history, in geography, in time? Because that's the big claim of the Bible. Not simply that God has is there and is some force behind the universe that you can merge yourselves with. The Bible is that God is speaking, acting, showing his purpose in time, in place, with people. And that's the first thing I want to just dwell on as we work our way towards Exodus 3. Revelation and history. Because revelation in this sense, this God revealing, God speaking, God talking sense, it's necessarily historical, it's necessarily particular, it's necessarily specific, confined. You know, it feels weird, doesn't it? Why this country, why this nation, why they're not anywhere else? A sister ministry to focus, to Uni Fellowship is Focus, which works particularly in the same goals we have, but with international students on the UTAS campus. And again, international students will ask. You talk to a mainland Chinese, and at some point, as they're beginning to look into Christianity and what it's about, they say, well, why in the Middle East? Why in the Middle East? Why not China? Why did God speak here to Abraham in some area around Mesopotamia and not over here in some province that has more people than all of Australia combined but that we've never heard of, in China? Why? It is an awkward thing, right? You know, why is the Bible an Eastern, Middle Eastern book? Why not a Western book, we might feel, those who have European descent? You know, it feels a bit kind of prejudiced, doesn't it? It's all Middle Eastern rather than Western. Why? If God is actually to speak, not just to be experienced in some broader sense, but if he's really to speak and to act, it requires a certain particularity. A Lord said to Abram, chapter 12, verse 1, or as Exodus chapter 3 puts it, if you come now to that main reading that we'll be looking at in Exodus chapter 3. A particular person, the angel of the Lord, appeared to him in the flames of fire, chapter 3, verse 2, from within a bush. And Moses saw the bush was on fire, it didn't burn up, and so Moses thought, I will go over, I will be walking to see this site, this bush, and why it doesn't burn up. And when God saw he'd gone over to look, God said to him, Moses, Moses. It's a concrete event. Either it happened or it didn't happen. And if it happened, it happened in a place. It had to happen in some place. It happened at a time. It had to happen at some time and not another. And so he said, verse 6, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. God becomes bound to particular people, particular events, particular times. If God speaking is a true thing, if it is possible for God to speak and he has in fact spoken, then it has to be this way. If God is a speaking God rather than just a feeling, vibe, experience, transcendental, philosophical thing, but if he's a relational thing, relationships happen to people in places at times. It has to be this way. The very fact of God being not merely transcendent but also personal makes God, in that sense, once he starts relating to this world, interested in history, interested in people. And so you can't say all religions generally get it right. Because the massive interference of Judaism and Christianity is that they go, well, who's talking about generally? The whole point of Judeo-Christian religion is specific. That's the whole point. But if you say all religions generally get the vibe right, the Jew would look at you, the traditional biblical Jew would look at you, the Christian would look at you, the traditional biblical Christian, and would say, I don't understand. A Our religion is all about the specific fact that God spoke to him. And God said something worth listening to. It's not just about the general vibe that we should all love each other, man. But it's that God's doing something. And he told someone about it. And he invites others to participate. And as the Bible does that, as the Bible unveils to us the claim of God speaking, it opens itself up to a very interesting thing. Evaluation, testing, critique. Christianity is a testable religion, not merely a mystical experience. So chapter 3 verse 12, God said, I will be with you, chapter 3 verse 12, and this will be the sign that it is I who have sent you. When you have brought the people up out of Egypt, you will worship God on this mountain. Either it happened or it didn't, in other words. Either you will leave Egypt or you won't, God is saying. And when you leave Egypt, you will meet with me here or you won't. It opens itself up to did it or didn't. Was it or wasn't it? And so that much later in the Bible, an important verse to remember in the light of people who want to say Christianity is faith and therefore irrational, much later in the Bible, in 1 Corinthians 15, we can be told, if Christ did not rise from the dead, the whole game is pitiful. It's not a case of, well, it gave you some meaning and some purpose and some direction in life, and that's nice for you, honey. No. If it's not true, it's wretched. It's shameful. It's deceitful. It's embarrassing. He reveals himself in history, the first point. He reveals himself in mercy, the second point. Revelation and grace. Grace meaning undeserved blessing. Benefit that wasn't earned. One way to define grace is to make an acronym of it. G, God's, R, riches, at Christ's expense. It's a Christian definition of grace. It's God giving out of his riches, not according to our deserving. It's not owed, not deserved, not earned, not obligated, but given, donated, if you like. All we deserve, you see, this is why it's so important. All we deserve, whether we're in Mesopotamia or in Western Europe or in Australia or in a province of China, all we deserve, Genesis chapter 1, 2 and 3, is the wrath of God, is accountability for our rejection of him, is our standing before him as those who've turned away from him. That's in terms of deserving, that's where we stand. We don't, in that sense, have a right to know God. We don't, in that sense, have a right to be forgiven. We don't, in a sense, have a right to have a chance to hear the message of forgiveness even. All we have a right for is to be held accountable for our willful rebellion. Revelation from God, speaking from God, is a wonderful gift. Without it, we could not even know God. We fallen people. We cannot know anything specific about God. We might speculate there might be a God. But anything specific, anything personal, anything real, we cannot know. You cannot. You just can't know God. You can't figure God out as fallen people. You can't know God savingly by looking at how beautiful the world is and marvelling at its beauty and so somehow attain enough knowledge to have a relationship. Salvation from God. We cannot do it. You cannot do it simply by being an heir to a wonderful tradition of religious form and ritual and wisdom. You cannot do it that way. You cannot come to know God merely through sitting still, perhaps on a beach, and there's a kind of island in the distance there, and it's all the stars, and there's a shooting star, and you're sitting there, and you feel so calm, and then maybe you smoke something, and then you just feel so at one. That might be cool, but you cannot know God and be saved by him that way. You see, the whole Bible is not an optional extra. It's not, if you're into it, then you might also like to read the manual. It's the deal. It's the only way that people can come to know and be saved by our God. It's not a footnote. It's not a, if you like the movie, read the novel. Unless God tells us we're lost in ignorance, unless God tells us promising, blessing, mercy words, we live under judgment. It's the big issue. It's the issue we must, at the university, we're raising the issue. Has God spoken? That's the issue. And if he has, what a wonderful gift. Still more wonderful when we hear just how wonderful his promises are. In Genesis 12, as we looked at, remember there it was Abraham going to a land where God says, I will bless, I will bless, I will bless, I will bless you and those who bless you. Hey, they can be blessed as well. And in fact, everyone else, as well as you and the people who bless you, will be blessed through you. This is the story in Genesis 12 that comes after Adam and Eve being kicked out of a land, right, out of the garden. And I will curse, and I will curse, and I will curse, and I will curse, and you will die. After that, God then says to Abram, hey, come with me. I'm taking you to a land where I will bless once more. I will bless you, and through you, the world that has been disgraced will be blessed once more. And so here, Moses meets with God in this miraculous occasion, tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, chapter 3, verse 1. He led his flock to the far side of the desert and comes to Horeb, the mountain of God, and there the angel of the Lord appeared to him in flames of fire within a bush. And Moses saw that though the bush was on fire, it didn't burn up. So Moses thought, I will go over and see this strange sight, why the bush doesn't burn up. And when the Lord had gone over to look, God called to him from within the bush, Moses, Moses. And Moses said, here I am. Do not come any closer, God said. Take off your sandal. This place you're standing is holy ground. And the Lord said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face. This is frightening. It's a frightening thing to encounter God. It's no small thing. It's definitely not just like some kind of ride or trip. It's a frightful thing to come to face to face with the one who folded the galaxies and made the mountains, right? And what does God say? Verse 7, I have indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I've heard them crying out because of their slave drivers. And I'm concerned about their suffering. So I've come down to rescue them from the hands of the Egyptians and bring them up out of that land into a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey, the home of Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites and Jebusites. Now the cry of the Israelites has reached me and I've seen the way the Egyptians are oppressing them. So now, go, I am sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. If God didn't choose to speak kindly to us, we would never know him. And if God didn't choose to be merciful to us, we would never be at peace with him. But he has. He has. And so the Bible is so fascinated with the descendants of Abraham, Isaac and Jacob. The nation that Moses played a part in the formation of. The people of Israel. The remnants of whom are now called the Jews. These are the people, the Bible says, that God chose to speak to. That's why they're so fascinated with them. Actually speak to. Promise, and God speaks in mercy. He doesn't just talk. He doesn't just give you words that comfort you when you have a loved one put underground. He doesn't just speak to you promises that inspire you when you feel threatened by cynicism. He acts. And so revelation and salvation. Let's read verse 7 again. The Lord said, I have seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I have heard them crying out because of their slave drivers. I am concerned about them, so I have come to rescue them from the hands of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of the land into a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey. Verse 9, And now the cry of the Egyptians has reached me. I've seen the way the Egyptians are oppressing them. So now go. I'm sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people out of Egypt. And Moses said, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? And God said, who cares who you are? I will be with you. And it will happen. So surely will it happen that the sign he has given, verse 12, is that after I've done it all, you will worship God on this mount. Not very helpful to Moses, perhaps. He goes, I'd like a sign now, if that's all right, rather than promising me a sign after the fact. He's making a point there. And the point is, so certain is the future when God speaks, So certain is your fate when God is with you, that his presence with you itself is a pledge of the future, is a down payment of the future. And so his promise for future action itself is assigned to us. So certain is his action. There are three things I want you to note about this sign, this promise. The first is it is based on God's previous promises. I am the God of Abraham. I am the God of Isaac. I am the God of Jacob. Because of the promises made to them, I will now come and save you. Or as it's described back in chapter 2 of Exodus, chapter 2, verse 23. Look there. During that long period, the king of Egypt died, and the Israelites groaned in their slavery and cried out, and their cry for help because of their slavery went up to God, and God heard their groaning and remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. It's not earned, it's not owed, it's not even purely driven by pity, as if things get bad enough, God is somehow bound to intervene. But it's God's choice, God's mercy, God's kindness, God's grace, God's promise. Not because they were a particularly intelligent nation, not because they were a particularly powerful nation, not because they were somehow a nation that God could look back before time began and guess that they're a nation that would somehow respond to him. Wow, big mistake there, if that's what they were. No, again and again. Go and read the book of Deuteronomy, which reinforces this point. Chapter 7 of Deuteronomy, say, or chapter 9. They were a small nation. They were a meager nation. They were a stiff-necked nation. The second thing I want you to notice, that it was based on God's grace and promises. And secondly, the rescue involves power, atonement, and judgment. It involves power, great workings of miracle, intervention of God in history. The book of Exodus is a book of national disaster, the toppling of a great empire. It is a really shocking, dramatic book. It's the shaming of a great king. It's the crumbling of a great economy. It's a shocking, cataclysmic event, the book of Exodus, from the point of view of the nation of Egypt. It is again and again that God will point to this event and say, look, Israel, your God is the living God. Look, Israel, when you doubt, remember, didn't God do this great thing in history? So don't lose heart. Look, Israel, although now you may feel weak and a failure, remember, has that event changed? No. God truly acted. Here's how chapter 3, verse 19 puts it. I know the king of Egypt will not let you go unless a mighty hand compels him. So I will stretch out my hand and strike the Egyptians with all the wonders that I will perform among them. So then I'll let them go. And Exodus tells the story of these great spectacular miracles, the 10 plagues struck upon the nation and ending with the slaying of their firstborn children. And the exodus of the Israelites and many who went with them. And then the great climactic parting of the sea and the crossing over that's described in Exodus 14 and 15, described so dramatically it feels a little like a reacting of the creation of the world, a little reacting of Noah and his flood. So eventful and powerful and spectacular was this rescue. A great display of divine intervention. A great act of miracle, and it was in that very act of power that there was rescue. From political oppression, yes. From homelessness and degradation, yes. From spiritual ignorance, yes. A rescue best seen in the final of the plagues, the Passover, where Israel stands victims of the same plague as Egypt. The earlier plagues, Israel is spared. But in the final plague, Israel also stands threatened with the judgment of God. A sacrifice. So that the blood of the sacrifice of the Passover lamb will enable the judgment of God to pass over. And so those who stand as guilty as Egypt can be let free. Themselves, you see, the Passover teachers deserve no special treatment. But it's only by God's great, powerful rescue and mercy and sacrifice. In the creation of a new community, the third thing I wanted to note there. We'll see that next week. Well, you know, next week, in class time at least. A new community knowing and loving and serving God and showing who God is to the world. Draw this to a close. C.S. Lewis described God as the great cosmic interferer. Have you ever felt that way? Maybe you do in subtle ways. You know what's right. You know what God wants of you. But you just wish he'd butt out now, thank you. Because you've got a better idea of what would make you happy, of what's important. Maybe some of you who have been converted later in life know that experience. Or some of you who are at the moment thinking about faith and these issues, you know that feeling. That I was going this way and then just God came in and slammed into my side door, interfered in my life. Poet Francis Thompson called God the hound of heaven. The one who pursues me, hounds me in my conscience, rattles me in my suffering and whispers to me in my pleasure. Not just a philosophical concept that you may or may not subscribe to. It's not just a sort of a religious version of a political party that you may or may not wave the flag for. He's not simply the one who kind of gives the umbrella under which your particular social group and community, you know, functions. He is a being who is active in history and he interferes in history. He is interfering in your world. It's relevant to you, practical for you, personal toward you. And that, well, when you really stop and meditate on that for a little bit, that the powerful God of the universe who can demand all allegiance from you is living and active and personal and present and relevant to you, that is, isn't it a little suffocating? A little frightening? A little inconvenient? That whatever you particularly think would be good for your life, wherever you would like to take your life, whatever things consume you and interest you and fascinate you and fill up your time and really get the best out of you and make you rise to the occasion, whatever those things are, that God is active in the world, intervening, interrupting, interfering, potentially, with the things that you think are so important. He's right behind you always. He's there with you at all times, in all places, whoever you're with and whatever you're thinking. Whether you're thinking about God or not, whether you have a wristband with WWWJD or not, whether you're particularly feeling Christian today or not, if this God is there, he is there, right there. Whether your youth group knows about what you're up to or not, whether your parents know about what you're up to or not, whether everyone around you thinks it's good what you're doing or not, God's there. Whether you believe in him or not, whether you like him or not. It's a suffocating, frightening thought. But all